This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're tuned to The Week in Review. Every Friday at this time, we welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week. And we are happy to have with us this hour Rick Berg, board member, Wisconsin Common Cause, former appointee of the Thompson administration, and columnist for Isthmus, Madison's weekly newspaper. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Ed Garvey is also with us, senior partner in the law firm of Garvey, McNeil, and McGilvery. He's also publisher of FightingBob.com and, of course, the organizer of Bob Fest, which I understand is coming up soon.
September 6th.
Yeah, I thought so. Good morning.
Bill McKibben.
So those are the first two mentions of Bob Fest. I'm going to keep track in this show, Joy, just so you know.
You know what? We'll let Ed get it out of his system. You've got all sorts of great people coming in, and somebody just signed up. So give us
Scott Ritter just signed up. So we have Scott Ritter, Phil Donahue, Jim Hightower, and Bill McKibben. Speaking of the energy crisis, he's the sort of the father of global climate change. Plus Granny D. And so
Granny D's coming back.
She's 89.
Oh, so, my God.
She said she got clearance from her doctors, so she's going to be there, and she will entertain, that's for sure.
She will, and we'll count to see if Ed brings it up a little bit during this program.
He will. I guarantee it.
We hope that listeners will join in with the news of the week that most interested you. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Barack Obama is going to be visiting Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have all three of the news anchors following him. And there's some talk in the news today that Barack Obama gets all sorts of attention from the news media, favorable attention from the news media, when John McCain goes all over. And he didn't have the news anchors following him to Iraq. He didn't have the news anchors following him to Latin America. What do you think of that, Ed?
Well, I think in part he invited people to join him in Czechoslovakia, only to find out that there is no Czechoslovakia. You know, I think Barack Obama is the sort of the new candidate on the scene, so to speak, and so there's great interest in what he has to say. McCain really hasn't said much over the past several months of interest, except that the surge worked, and then you take a look at what's going on in Iraq and say, well, it's working so well, we can send these troops now to Afghanistan, which is not going well. So I just think there's a natural interest in what Obama is going to be doing in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Rick?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there is a mainstream bias in favor of Obama.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe, isn't it, Ed? But I think that's pretty clear. However, I think that the trip is quite it's legitimate news. I mean, this is really Obama's chance to step out onto the world stage and show off his ability to deal with foreign policy and military issues and things like that. And so I think there's legitimate news interest in the trip. It can be a two-edged sword. I mean, it's a bit of a high-stakes, deal for Obama. I mean, he could just as easily go over there and make some awful gaffe. Not that I'm expecting him to, but when you've got that sort of media attention, if you do, you can be sure it's going to get play on the news.
If he gives them a Dukakis moment in the tank.
Yeah, the helmet in the tank thing. We know he's capable of that because someone put a bowling ball in his hand in Pennsylvania. That was a bit of a Dukakis
moment.
Don't
forget, it was Bush 41 who fell on his face at Serb Hall with a bowling ball.
So. Did he really?
Yeah. He tried to let it go, and it just didn't go.
Well, he was the one also sort of puzzled by what are those things at the grocery stores that you're passing the food over to check the price on. He didn't know what that was.
But your party has moved forward. Now we have John McCain who's found out that there's an internet.
Yeah, he just discovered that there is an internet. So, I mean, he's learning. We know he's got a learning curve that he's working on. But getting back to the Obama trip, I think it'll be interesting to see what kind of response he gets over there. But in addition, part of what's interesting about Obama is that particularly on the war in Iraq and tough on terror and all that stuff, he's clearly moderating his position from his primary positions. And I think he understands now what's at stake in the Middle East in terms of success. And so he's trekking to the center, clearly, which is probably smart on his part, because I think he wants to win the election, and I think he knows he has to do that. So this trip is an opportunity for him to build credibility in an area where all the polls show that right now McCain has an advantage. It's probably the only area where McCain has a significant advantage over Obama right now.
Ed?
Well, I think it is, if you believe the polls, it is the one area where people have more confidence in McCain. But, you know, I think what's happening in the world is so scary, and what's happening to our economy is so frightening that that's going to overshadow this trip. I mean, when you have major banks or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on the verge of collapse, you have the head of the Federal Reserve saying things are looking bad and Bush saying, I'm an optimist. You know that things are a little dicey.
We'll talk more about the economy in a bit. But let me play a clip from Barack Obama's speech about Iraq. He had a piece in the New York Times as well on Monday, My Plan for Iraq. And here it is.
Our troops and our NATO allies are performing heroically in Afghanistan. But I have argued for years that we lack the resources to finish the job because of our commitment to Iraq.
And John McCain had this to say about Barack Obama saying that we should redeploy troops from Iraq and send them to Afghanistan.
Senator Obama will tell you we can't win in Afghanistan without losing in Iraq. In fact, he has it exactly backwards. It is precisely the success of the surge in Iraq that shows us the way to succeed in Afghanistan.
So, Ed?
Well, you know, I don't think we can win in Afghanistan. You know, the Soviets lost, the British lost. You know, this is incredible terrain. The problem we have with Pakistan working with some of the insurgents on the border, I mean, this is really a total disaster in terms of American foreign policy. So if you look at Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, there are very few good stories to be told. As far as the surge is concerned, we have now the sovereign government of Iraq asking us to go home. And so President Bush says, well, we're not going to listen to them. I mean, we're going to stay there, or as John McCain, who may have caused this by saying we could stay for 100 years, I think he forced al-Maliki to say to his people, they're crazy. We're going to get them out of here much sooner than that.
Rick?
Well, I think, frankly, the fact that the Iraqi government is now sort of bringing up the issue of when are you going to... We can't miss you if you don't leave, sort of thing. You know, I mean, I think that to some degree, that's a measure of the success that we've had in Iraq. I mean, Iraq really has, to a large degree, stabilized since the surge began. The incidents of violence are down. The killings are down. There are still episodes here and there, but they're not as frequent and not as severe as they were prior to the surge. So in terms of Iraq, I think things are moving in the right direction. Afghanistan seems to be more problematic these days and perhaps more in need of attention from the U.S. than Iraq right now. But I think what you're going to see, regardless of who's elected, is a wind down of U.S. presence in Iraq, whether or not we're going to have a presence there for an extended period of time through military bases or whatever, I think remains to be seen. But I would think that that's going to be likely, even if we pull out. It has to be, and it will be, I think. But I think that you're going to see a significant pullout of U.S. troops over the course of the next year.
We're broke. I mean, the problem is we're spending $370 million a day on Iraq, and the country is broke. So something's going to have to change. And I think when the American people finally make the connection between the fact that we have failing schools and no health care for millions of people, that's when the economics will come to the forefront and will dictate that we must get out of Iraq.
Now, let me take a call. Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've noticed that the Bush administration has changed their foreign policy to Barack Obama's foreign policy.
How so?
The administration said that Iraq was the central war in the fight on terror. Obama said it was Afghanistan, Pakistan. Bush has recently said he would advise the next president that their biggest challenge will come from Pakistan. This week, the Bush administration also announced that they've changed their position and will participate in talks with Iran, as Obama said he would do as president. And finally, Bush said that they will draw down troops from Iraq, and they will deploy more troops to Afghanistan, which has always been Obama's position. So it looks like the Bush administration is admitting that Obama was right in his foreign policy.
Is that what's going on, Rick?
Well, I mean, all of what Dave said, I think, is essentially true. The way he characterized it, we may quibble a little bit about. But certainly it's a change in the Bush approach to Iran when we say that we're going to sit down and talk to them. That's a pretty significant change.
Not kidding.
And the focus on Afghanistan over Iraq would also be a significant shift in the U.S. foreign policy position in the Middle East. But again, as we said, and I don't want to go over things we've already discussed, I think Iraq is stabilized to a considerable degree where we can either start to withdraw U.S. forces or we can reallocate some of them to the Afghan issue. But I think we've succeeded to a large degree in accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish in Iraq. We've got some issues in Afghanistan. There's the issue of bin Laden, which continues to sit out there. And you know, I'm sure that in the remaining months of the Bush presidency, there's going to be a pretty strong push to see if they can locate Osama bin Laden and deal
with him.
Well, and Dick Cheney, who's being held in an undisclosed location, along with Osama bin Laden.
Ed, what about the Bush administration adopting Barack's foreign policy?
Well, I don't think they have much choice because things have not worked out at all in Iraq. I mean, the so-called surge was supposed to provide a breathing space for the government to come together, take care of the oil problems and the infrastructure. None of that's happened. The Kurds walked out of the parliament the other day because of the concern over who's going to control their oil. Now we have ExxonMobil, BP, and others who are going to be trying to enter into long-term contracts for the oil, our oil that's hidden under the Iraqi sand. And you know, when you have Maliki saying that he will not allow Americans to use bases in Iraq to attack his friends in Iran, we've lost. I mean, the fact is, the Iranians are the ones who are the big victors in this struggle in the Middle East, and it's kind of scary. So I think even Bush is finally realizing that this isolated position of the United States is not going to work.
Speaking of President Bush, we'll talk about his talk about the economy this week, trying to reassure us that the economy is doing okay. And other issues involving the economy, the failure of the bank in California, the bailout of Freddie and Fannie, and whatever else you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. This is The Week in Review with Ed Garvey and Rick Berg. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Yet despite the challenges we face, our economy has demonstrated remarkable resilience. While the unemployment rate has risen, it remains at 5.5%, which is still low by historical standards. And the economy continued to grow in the first quarter of this year. The growth is slower than we would have liked, but it was growth nonetheless.
As President Bush on Tuesday, I believe, trying to tell us that while the economy has some troubles, it's sound. And I'm wondering, Ed Garvey, if you share that assessment.
Well, I think what's gone unreported is that he had just watched Peter Sellers in the movie Bean there. And he came out to the bank of microphones to say, everything's just fine. And of course, the head of the Federal Reserve is saying, we're in trouble. The labor market's soft. The financial industry is in trouble. So, you know, when you're down to feeling good that the president says everything's okay, it's kind of, you know, doing a great job out there, Brownie or Benny or whichever one he's talking about. It's, I think, very frightening because you read between the lines in the New York Times and other papers, they are afraid that the financial empire could just collapse. I mean, given the drain on our resources, the falling dollar, the problems we have with exports and imports. So, you know, you take a look at it, or the bad mortgages. I think we need a change in administrations quickly. Maybe we could get them to move up the date.
Are you, where do you stand on this, Rick?
Well, I sort of agree with Ed on this. I mean, I think to a large degree, Washington is insulated from the problems that most average Americans are facing. I mean, when you look across the board, it's really quite unnerving. I mean, you have this past week, we've had, you know, the Fed saying, well, Fannie Mae is okay, Freddie Mac is okay, you know, they're not going to go belly up. I mean, just having to say that is a little scary. You've got all these people standing outside in line outside the bank out in mm-hmm. California to get their money out. I mean, shades of It's a Wonderful Life and, you know, runs on the bank. You've got home equity rates in the United States right now that have fallen to their lowest levels since World War II. You've got foreclosures soaring. You've got huge losses in, you know, in the financial giants. The government had to bail out Bear Stearns not that long ago to keep them afloat. Merrill Lynch, they've been talking about, could be shaky. I mean, it really, when you look at the entire landscape, it's scary and shaky. And you don't have to read between the lines, Ed, I don't think, to see the fear that's out there that all we need is one more whatever to push this over the edge. And if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had gone under, I think that could have been the trigger for, you know, Depression 2.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't say that lightly. I think the atmosphere in this country right now is economically is as perilous as the late 1920s.
Well, now I want to put my money in my mattress. I think it's
that unnerving.
You know, I got a letter from my bank asking me for a financial statement to see whether or not I could justify a loan. I felt like sending them one saying, you better tell me how good you are because I'm not sure you got the money.
Let me see your financials.
I mean, for example, even this IndyMac bank that failed, they said, well, don't worry, up to $100,000, you're protected. Now they're not cash. Other banks are not cashing their cashier's checks from Indy Bank because they're not they're not sure that they're going to have the money to back it up. So if the feds have to go in there with a couple of $1 billion to save IndyMac just from the $100,000 guarantees, people over and above that, well, they're going to get 50 cents on the dollar.
I saw that the Wisconsin Bankers Association, though, said banks in Wisconsin are sound. They weren't participating in these risky mortgages.
Well, Wisconsin banks have traditionally been a lot better off than the rest of the country. We're pretty tight in terms of controls. But there'll be like a fly buzzing around. If Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae or something goes under, they're going to have serious problems.
Well, right. I mean, if that were to happen, all banks, even the good banks in Wisconsin, and I would agree that traditionally banks in Wisconsin are more conservative, more well-run than banks in a lot of other places in the country. And the percentage of what you call those risky loans, Joy, is rather low in Wisconsin compared to other states. I mean, you saw a lot of those in the high-value market areas out in California and the East Coast. That was a very popular way for people to get into home ownership, essentially get into a house they couldn't afford at a very low rate. And now, you know, the clock is striking midnight for a lot of those people.
Yeah.
But Ed's right. I mean, if there's a national financial crisis, and I think, you know, we still sit on the edge of that, it's going to drag everybody down, the good and the bad. And as Ed said, there's a lot of good banks in Wisconsin that could get hurt. I mean, if Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac were to go under, that would affect the ability of millions of people to access money for mortgages because of the way the financial system is structured in the U.S.
Let's take another caller, Mike in Langlade County. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I would just report that Martin Feldstein was on the radio two nights ago on a program at 6 o'clock that comes from Boston. He is the economist that sold Ronald Reagan on supply-side economics. And he said, recovery of the real estate market is what is required to turn the economy around, and he thinks it's underway because real estate prices have already fallen 15%. He thinks they'll have to fall another 15%, and he's afraid that we will actually overshoot that 30% decrease in real estate prices, and they will fall even further before the economy really does turn around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the caller is essentially correct. You know, I was hearing about 2 years ago, I think, that there were predictions that real estate values, even in Dane County, were going to fall 20-30%. Well, no one was believing it at the time, but and perhaps in Dane County they won't fall that far. But I think they're clearly falling. And in other parts of the country, they've already fallen that far.
Well, it's also
but,
Rick.
But what I was going to say, though, is, too, when you look at the last 15 years, the growth in the value of real estate, I mean, when you look at it at a national level, dramatically outpaced the growth of personal income. In that is the housing bubble. I mean, the value of housing was increasing way too fast. And this is a necessary correction in the marketplace. And it's going to be painful for a lot of people. It sure is, and it's already painful, but I think it was quite necessary.
But there's so much uncertainty out there. I mean, if you take people who are worried about their 401ks, you know, suddenly if they hear the market goes down 200 points, 300 points, 500 points, and they just see their life savings going out the window. I mean, most middle class Americans have two assets. One is their home, and the other is a you know, some kind of a pension plan. And we know that pension plans, the traditional ones, have been in trouble for a long time. Now we look at the 401ks. You don't hear anybody talking about Bush's idea of privatizing Social Security.
Right. Well, yeah. And yesterday, too, I was listening to a report yesterday that was commenting on that issue. The dramatic increase in the amount of money that's being pulled out of 401ks just to pay living expenses to get from today to tomorrow, it's gone up dramatically. I can't remember what the percentage was, but it was way up. And that also is, I think, an alarm signal for the economy in terms of how many people out there are in serious trouble.
Yeah, let's turn from the economy to energy. Al Gore yesterday challenging the nation to produce every kilowatt of electricity through wind, sun, and other earth-friendly energy sources within the next 10 years.
The survival of the United States of America as we know it is at risk, and even more if more should be required. The future of human civilization is at stake.
Well, that's a lot at stake.
Well, and when President Bush left the G8, he said goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. I thought, you know, it was a nice way for him to tell the rest of the world to jump in the lake. Bill McKibben will be at Bob Fest.
mentioned number three.
But he is
a long series.
He is certainly the expert that we look to, and along with Al Gore. It is frightening. And I was listening to someone the other day who was saying, we shouldn't talk about global warming. We should talk about climate disruption, because global warming gives people the impression that there's a slow, gradual warming up that is evenly distributed. And what he was suggesting is that it's not that at all. It's going to be violent storms, floods, and forest fires, and so on. And if you look at the headlines in the paper over the past several weeks, that's about what we have. Fires all over California, floods in Wisconsin, bad storms headed toward the hurricane season. So something dramatic has to happen. Clearly, Bush can't do it. I would hope Barack Obama will, and I think he will.
Yeah. Do you think we can do this, Rick? 10 years, have all of our electricity through all these alternative sources?
Well, I don't. No, I don't. I frankly don't. I agree with Gore to the extent that there's a lot at stake, and maybe the future of the United States of America is at stake, and maybe, as he says, the future of civilization is at stake. But I don't think in 10 years we can switch all of our crude oil demand to solar and wind power. I just think that's impractical. That doesn't mean that I oppose increasing
the use. Yes, you are.
No, it doesn't mean I oppose increasing the use of solar and wind. But I would also add nuclear to the mix, and we need to do more drilling and exploration for natural gas and oil and crude oil reserves within our own country and offshore and things like that. And there's huge reserves of that underneath South Dakota and other lands that are part of the United States. And I think that has to be part of the equation. It isn't. I think you have to pursue multiple strategies. It isn't just one or the other. So I think we all agree that something needs to be done. There's a lot at stake. The ability of the American people to control their energy destiny, I think, is critical to the future of this country. And we need to end our dependence on foreign oil.
But the most interesting 30-second spot that I have heard recently is T. Boone Pickens saying we can't drill our way out of this one. We got to have solar and wind. And
well,
so on.
But I think that's an interesting ad. But I would disagree with him only to the extent that I think drilling helps us out of this. I think that's part of the long-term strategy. I'm not opposed to developing these other technologies and cars that can run on hydrogen or cars that can run on natural gas. Those are all good things, but those are very long-term strategies. And while we pursue those, I think we should also be pursuing more of our own reserves when it comes to crude oil. And the one thing I was going to say is that crude oil does not just go into gasoline to power our cars. When you look at the list of products that depend on crude oil, it's a long list.
Oh, yeah.
I could read it, but I won't waste the time. But there's a long list of items that we use every day that require crude oil. So it isn't just the issue of our cars and the internal combustion engine. So the country needs to develop our own reserves and refine them and put them on the market, and that'll help with the issue of the supply and the demand.
Let me ask you, Ed, President Bush did lift that executive order that banned offshore drilling for more oil and told Congress you need to do the same thing. What would be wrong with lifting that ban on?
Well, it's going to have no impact whatsoever on the shortage or on the price of gasoline at the pump, and it does risk our natural resources, and so fortunately the Congress is not going to go along with it, and I don't think President Obama will either. But for the president to do it, just showmanship. I wish he'd take a vacation. You know, somebody said, what's wrong with Camp David these days? Can't he take a break? I mean, he just keeps coming out and making comments that make you wonder if he's stable. And for him to suddenly say, we're lifting the executive order, now it's up to Congress, I think is almost silly.
But I would argue that drilling and exploration for more crude oil and natural gas on United States land will eventually have an impact on price because it'll affect supply and demand. That is the law of the marketplace. Yeah. And if we can increase the supply, I know it's hard. It's a hard concept, Ed, to understand. But if we can increase the supply and we're producing more of our own crude oil and natural gas, it's eventually going to have an effect. It's not going to have an effect
but let me be rude.
Tomorrow or next week or next month or even next year.
Ed wants to be rude.
I want to be rude. think of me as Ann Coulter. You know, here we are in this state, for example, and the administration is talking about a $1.9 billion expansion of I-94 from the Marquette Interchange down to the Illinois border. For heaven's sakes, if we're talking about you know, oil and gasoline and savings, couldn't we be talking about public transportation and bullet trains and some way to do that would have a much greater impact than any drilling in Anwar or off the coast?
Well, I think that needs to be part of it, too. Again, I'd like to see a comprehensive approach to this, not something at the exclusion of another. But yeah, I think the whole issue of that rail corridor between Milwaukee and Chicago is an idea that needs to be looked at. Even Schwarzenegger is talking about a high-speed rail system.
Or joining California. The administration of Obama, which I thought was interesting.
That's true.
Oh, that's right. He did. But
get back
that.
Into the Kennedy family.
But, I mean, even California is now looking at that issue with the support of Schwarzenegger of a high-speed rail system running up and down the coast, which, again, makes sense because of the population density out there.
Yeah. Did you hear Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker? She was upset to hear President Bush scold Congress for not doing enough for energy and other issues, and here's what she had to say about President Bush.
God bless him. Bless his heart. The President of the United States, a total failure, losing all credibility with the American people on the economy, on the war, on energy, you name the subject. And for him to be challenging Congress when we are trying to sweep up after his mess over and over and over again.
Oh, what do you think of that, Ed?
Understated. you know, I mean, the simple fact is that this administration has been an enormous failure. I think historians will look back and say that this was the turning point for a number of things. But clearly on energy, it's been a failure. On the CAFE standards, it's been a failure. On education, it's a failure. On healthcare, it's a failure. So I think Nancy Pelosi was absolutely right, and I'm glad to hear a little fight in the dog.
Yeah, Nancy.
This coming from the person who leads the House of Representatives, and what was it? The latest Gallup poll that came out a few days ago showed congressional approval at 13%.
Yeah,
that was a mistake.
This is the 13. This is the head of the 13%ers that are lecturing Bush. Now Bush's approval rating in the same poll was at 28%, I think, or something like that. So he's got twice the support that Congress has. I mean, Congress shouldn't be talking about the president being a failure. There's a lot of people that understand and properly put the blame on Congress for being a real do-nothing Congress.
I think it's George Steinbrenner's fault.
Yeah, yeah. And I understand that.
Let's talk a little bit about the cover of The New Yorker this week. Showed Barack Obama dressed as a cartoon character looking like Osama bin Laden, his wife looking like some sort of radical militant with an AK-47 strapped around her. The flag was burning in the fireplace.
And there was a framed picture of Osama bin Laden over the fireplace.
Yeah. The New Yorker said this was satire against the right-wing caricatures and stereotypes and the fears that the right wing is trying to spread about Barack Obama. The Obama campaign wasn't amused. They thought that was offensive. What did you think of that cover, Ed?
I said I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, but I think, you know, I get The New Yorker because I want to see the cartoons and read Seymour Hersh. I think you just have to smile and say, look, that's The New Yorker. It may have been over the top, but as Bill Maher said, if you can't use the cover of The New Yorker for irony, what can you do or where can you go? So I think they probably overreacted, and what I think it scares people into thinking about is the kind of 30-second spots that can be used in the coming months that they will say, well, it's no worse than The New Yorker. But that's something we're just going to have to deal with, the Willie Horton stuff that will come out like the Mississippi rushing down the
Rick?
Well, I thought it was a bit over the top, and it probably did what the New Yorker wanted it to do, which was to generate attention and publicity for their publication, and in that extent, or to that extent, they really succeeded. But when you look at the polls, I think there's about 12% of the American public in most polls that still believe that Obama's a Muslim. He's not. No, I'm not part of the 12%. And I don't think that the right wing attacks, if you call them that, Joy, on Obama, have really tried to perpetuate that for the most part. I mean, there might be some very fringe type people, but the mainstream, you know, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, I don't think go after Obama trying to promote the notion that he's Muslim. They don't do that.
I think he uses his middle name.
The Hussein thing.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. You know, and maybe it's more subtle. I don't know, but. Be that as it may, I don't think in the scheme of things it's really going to matter much, but I'm sure the Obama campaign is concerned to the extent that it reinforces unfair or inaccurate stereotypes of
who
Obama is.
It's forced a lot of us to talk to one another about the role of race in this country in terms of the election. I was with a group of people about a week ago. And I was surprised at the number of them who said they didn't think a black man could be elected president of the United States given the racial attitudes. I don't agree with them, and I think that Obama is going to be elected. But I think the New Yorker can be credited for at least bringing the subject out into the open. I mean, I really do think we need to have that discussion. I remember when South Africa, when Mandela, who's 90 years old today, was released from prison, they established a truth commission, and Desmond Tutu was the leader of that effort. We've never dealt with race in an intelligent discussion as a nation, and I think this election is going to force us to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly going to force a discussion, but I do think a black man could be elected president of the United States. I don't know if that'll be Barack Obama, but I think it's also possible that a woman could be elected too. I mean, I think it has to be the right female candidate, the right black candidate, or whatever, and I guess it remains to be seen when it comes to Obama if he's the right black candidate.
Do you think if Obama comes to BobFest that would be the key?
I think that would be the key to victory, and I'm sort of surprised that he hasn't accepted the invitation already, and that's mention number five,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, we're past our break time, but I did want to touch, you just reminded me that both McCain and Obama spoke before the NAACP convention this week. Much attention was placed especially on Barack Obama's comments because they followed Jesse Jackson's accident, where he talked about Barack's talking down to black people and that he wanted to cut off something of Barack's to, I guess, take him down a notch or two.
Yeah. I don't think you can repeat any of what he actually said on NPR.
But Obama said before the NAACP convention, hey, you know, some are criticizing me for talking tough about personal responsibility. Well, I'm going to continue talking tough. We need government programs to help those in need, but we also need to pull ourselves up from our bootstraps. Ed, what did you think of that?
Well, if Barack wanted to distance himself from Jesse Jackson, it could not have been done more abruptly or effectively. So I don't think it's going to have any lasting impact. As to McCain's speech to the NAACP, I think it was a rather gracious moment where he congratulated Obama on his selection. You know, it's there are things happening that I believe portend will have a positive impact. I think we are talking a little more civilly, at least the candidates are, and I think the campaigns are. Whether the outsiders who will pour millions of dollars into these races will or not, I'm not sure. But I suspect in the debates that you'll see a certain civility between Barack Obama and John McCain that will bode well for the American people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think so, too. In terms of the speeches, I think Obama's pretty much got the right message when it comes to personal responsibility. And he's saying things that people like Bill Cosby were saying several years ago. I mean, I think there's a willingness now to listen to very candid talk at the national level about what's wrong in this country when it comes to our families and fatherhood and all that sort of stuff. And Obama has tapped effectively into that. So in terms of Jesse Jackson, I agree with that in the sense that in the end, politically speaking, it was probably a good thing for Obama to create some distance between him and Jesse Jackson. So while Jackson's comments were offensive and indefensible, I think they're going to play to Obama's political advantage in the end.
We are talking with Rick Berg and Ed Garvey. This is the Friday Week in Review. We welcome your calls. We're going to talk about the sale of Budweiser or Anheuser-Busch in our next segment, talk about the moving of the headquarters of Miller Beer to Chicago, and maybe the moving of Brett Favre to another team in the NFL. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest, Ed Garvey, senior partner law firm of Garvey, McNeil, and McGilvery, publisher of FightingBob.com and organizing BobFest, which is September 6th. And Rick Berg is a board member of Wisconsin Common Cause and a columnist for Isthmus. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn. Actually, it's Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn. Veronica and her guests will take a look at the cover of this week's New Yorker magazine, depicting what the editors insist is a satire of Barack and Michelle Obama. More on that coming up after 9 o'clock. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Ed Garvey and Rick Berg. It's our week in review. And another story in the news this week, gentlemen, is the sale of Anheuser-Busch to the Belgian company InBev, $52 billion or something like that. It was something that Anheuser-Busch had been fighting for quite some time, but then agreed to this week. A lot of people are sad that this American icon is being sold to a foreign brewery. What do you think about it, Ed?
Well, I think it's certainly disrupting to the people in St. Louis. Some 6,000 people work for Anheuser-Busch in the St. Louis area. I think it's too bad that Miller has been sold to a South African company. We don't have any national companies anymore, but we have Spotted Cow and Lake Louie, so I think we'll be doing all right. Nobody's going to go thirsty. But I think it's an example of what's happened to the dollar. The dollar is down so far that almost everything is a reasonable purchase for a European company. It's $52 billion here. Looks a lot different from Brussels than it does from St. Louis.
Well, it's sort of amazing. I mean, you look at all the stuff. I mean, it's almost like America is up for sale. Who was it that bought the Chrysler building a week or two ago? That was a Dubai? Somebody in Dubai bought the Chrysler? Or was it Dubai? I don't know. Bought the Chrysler building in New York City. Anheuser-Busch is sold to InBev. I mean, this is just a pattern that's been going on for a long time, and it's sort of disturbing, really.
Yeah. Well,
I mean,
when
you think about all the foreign interests that are owning uniquely American companies, buildings, etc., I'm a little troubled by this.
Yeah, are you troubled by Milwaukee moving the headquarters to Chicago?
I mean, because it's good jobs leaving Wisconsin, and it's they're just going down the road instead of being Brewer fans, they'll be Cub fans. So I think when you lose those good paying jobs, it naturally has an adverse impact on the economy. But I think it's like the paper today is talking about the 100th anniversary of General Motors in Flint, Michigan, where they used to employ, I think, 80,000 people. They had a party to celebrate the 100th birthday, and nobody was there from General Motors. I mean, so it's pretty scary stuff.
Well, but the Miller thing coming on top of the GM plant closing in Janesville, and I mean, it's just another black eye for the state. Not that the state could have stopped it. I mean, the merger occurred some time ago, but it's sort of sad to see that presence leaving Milwaukee. I've always associated Miller with Milwaukee, Miller Park. I mean, that whole thing, that's part of what Wisconsin has been all about for a long time. And now, the decision to move, eventually, most of that's going to move to Chicago. You know that, Ed.
Sure.
Eventually, that's all going to be in Chicago. And I think that, too, is sort of sad for the state of Wisconsin. I mean, these things...
It's not like Wisconsin is the problem. I mean, when I get these people saying that it's our taxes or whatever, that has nothing to do with it. When you're talking about a $52 billion price tag for Anheuser-Busch, they weren't sitting around worrying about property taxes in the suburbs of St. Louis.
Right. No, there are other forces at work. I agree with you there.
And, well, and this falling dollar and the, mm-hmm. the tremendous mm-hmm. cost of what's going on in Iraq, everything goes back to that, it seems to me.
Well, the weak dollar, yeah, the weak dollar is driving a lot of what ails the U.S. right now. These foreign purchases of American companies, the cost of crude oil, all of that is being impacted by the weak dollar policies of the federal government, and that's a serious problem.
Yeah. We also had some other sad job news this week with General Motors announcing it will shut down that Janesville plant sooner than expected.
Right.
And Midwest Airlines will cut 1,200 jobs this summer, 40% of its current workforce, presumably due to the high fuel costs. It's kind of sad, Rick.
Well, it is. I mean, you're right. I didn't mention the Midwest Express mm-hmm. thing, but again, you know, having to slash that many jobs, but a lot of airlines are in trouble because their costs have just been soaring. I mean, I think, you know, the last figures I saw, I can't remember, 10 or 15 years ago, it was like 6 or 8% of the airline's budget went to fuel. Now it's up to about 35 to 40%, somewhere in there. Well, they're being squeezed. And I mean, I don't know who can afford to travel anymore. It's not very, I mean, it's people like Ed, you know, these attorney types. That,
yeah, right.
But I mean, the average person is finding it very difficult to justify traveling. You know, with $4 a gallon gasoline and the high cost of food and all of the other products that have to be transported, you know, via truck, et cetera, there aren't many people that have a lot of cash laying around to take flights.
Take that up to $5, $6 mm-hmm. a gallon. You're going to see some serious disruptions in this country.
Well,
I mean, the impact of $4.11 has been disruptive, but just wait till that happens. But I think our national debt is, what, now $5 trillion?
No, something like
when
that.
When Bush came into office, we were arguing about where to spend the surplus. So here we are. Our health care delivery system is in trouble. Energy is in trouble. All of these things are in trouble. And there doesn't seem to be any grand plan that comes forward other than the president making silly comments
well,
at a news conference.
Well, the other part of it that's sort of scary, and you've seen the price of crude oil back off in the last few days. It's dropped a little bit anyway. But I have said to others, and I maintain, that if you know, they were talking about crude oil rising perhaps even to $200 a barrel.
Right.
And I don't think the market can support that price. You talk about a serious dislocation. But if crude oil ever seriously began to approach $200 a barrel or stayed there for any length of time, should it get there, I maintain that that's when armies will cross borders. I mean, in human history, there have been wars over food. I really seriously believe that unless we come up with a solution to this energy mess that we're in, you're going to see wars over energy.
Berg calls for a wall between U.S. and Canada.
Whoa. Let's talk. We only have a few more minutes and a few more stories to go over. Here's one that I almost forgot about. Wisconsin's Commerce Secretary Jack Fisher announced his resignation on Wednesday, 10 days after news reports surfaced that he billed taxpayers for more than $21,000 on international trips over a short period of time. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that Fisher and a top aide billed taxpayers for more than $21,000 for three international trips in less than 3 months this spring. He needed to resign, you think, Rick Burke?
Well, I think it was a profound embarrassment for the administration. I mean, to the extent to which I think it's important for the Wisconsin Secretary of Commerce to go overseas and meet with people, I can buy into that notion that that's an important ingredient in terms of generating business for the state of Wisconsin. But it was the extravagance, I think, of the cost that this guy incurred that really did him in. I mean, you can go to Munich or Frankfurt or London or whatever and stay in affordable hotels, but when you're ringing up hotel bills of $550 or something a night, spending $80 to $100 on a meal, I mean, that's just a bit outrageous. There's no justification for that sort of expenditure level. So I think he probably did the right thing by packing his bags and leaving town.
Mm-hmm. Ed?
Oh, I don't. It's just too obvious. I mean, obviously, you shouldn't be using taxpayer dollars for that sort of extravagance. I've often questioned the value of these great trade missions anyway. It seems to me like it's an opportunity for the governor or others to fill a plane full of potential contributors and take them over to Ireland. You know, what are we going to learn?
And drink Irish beer.
Well, that's all right.
You don't have any problem with that part of the trip.
Well, maybe everybody's waiting to talk about our last item in the week in review. Brett Favre. Brett Favre says he wants to unretire and...
Secretary of Commerce.
there's a slot for him.
Yeah. Greta Van Susteren scored the first interview with Brett Favre since these rumors surfaced this week. And I don't know, Ed. You know what the NFL is does with your work with the NFL. Yeah. What's going on?
Well, the anti-tampering thing is, of course, the silliest of all. I mean, if you're under a contract of any kind with someone, you can't talk to any potential employer, or that team will suffer a big loss. So I don't know whether the Vikings did or didn't, but the rule itself is pretty silly. I think the Packers ought to either bring Brett back or just release him. I mean, he's done a tremendous amount of good for the state of Wisconsin and for the Green Bay Packers, and you might as well treat him with dignity on the way out, no matter how you do it. So I suspect that's what's going to happen. They have a terrific president and CEO now in Mark Murphy, who I think understands what the issues are.
Yeah, you were referring to the Green Bay Packers filing tampering charges against the Minnesota Vikings over what the team believes was inappropriate contact with Brett Favre.
Yeah, I mean, if you called, or if Fox News called you about a job, that's tampering, and they could name a draft choice or a Kathleen Dunn would be compensation for this breach of ethics. I mean, it just seems kind of, you know, silly, and I frankly haven't heard anybody use that in years.
Yeah. Well, should Brett stay or go, Rick Burton?
Well, this whole thing is a clash of gigantic egos. I mean, that's the only way I think you can understand it. We're not talking about this program. We're talking about Brett Favre and the Green Bay Packers and Ted Thompson. But I mean, if Brett's skills were on the decline, I might look at this differently. But in the 2007 season, the guy had a real renaissance year, and I mean, he had one of his best seasons ever. So I think it would be hard to advance the argument that his skills are on the decline. I don't think they are. My feeling is that, and if winning is what matters, and I know Ed doesn't necessarily agree with this, I think winning is what matters in the NFL. And when you look at the Green Bay Packers, I think most people would have to agree that Brett Favre gives the Green Bay Packers the best chance of winning, and certainly a significant better chance than Aaron Rodgers. So if Aaron Rodgers is going to have his nose out of joint, should the Green Bay Packers take Brett back as their starting quarterback, then my recommendation would be to trade poor Aaron Rodgers to another team. Let him play somewhere else. They've got a couple of young quarterbacks they can groom to succeed Brett when Brett indeed does truly want to leave the game. But this is a guy who for all practical purposes, has been the Green Bay Packers for the last 16 years or so. And as one columnist put it, and I've said it this way before myself, Favre is essentially the Babe Ruth of football, and he is a legend. And sometimes, I think as one person put it yesterday, these you know, the great ones are you know, real pain in the asses.
I didn't have to bleep that. That's okay.
Yeah, thanks.
George Carlin, where are you?
You know, we're gonna have to leave it there, gentlemen. We're out of time. Thanks, Rick Berg, for being here.
Thanks, Joe.
And thanks, Ed Garvey. Let me also thank Karen Prager, who is spending her last day as the producer of this program. Karen has been producing the program for, somewhere around 3 years on a part-time or full-time basis. Karen, moving on, we will miss her. We wish her very well. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Rob Ferret and Sarah Carroll, who also helped produce this program. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. If you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.